Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, Your Excellency. Welcome to the Nehru Memorial Lecture for 2003. Very briefly, the Nehru Memorial Trust, for those of you who don't know, was created on the death of Pandit Nehru, and my grandfather, late grandfather, Lord Mountbatten, was the first chairman, and I succeeded him in 1979. Trust has always had two objects, both of which it regards as its equal purpose. One is to bring students from India to the United Kingdom, principally to Trinity College, Nehru's alma mater, to study, and the other is to deliver an annual lecture. This lecture originally was conceived to take place last autumn, but has been delayed in order that Professor Linda Colley was able to travel to India in order to really immerse herself deeply in the subject. Henry Ford it was who said, "History is bunk." Now, I certainly don't subscribe to that view, notwithstanding the fact I'm afraid I failed O-level history. I never got to A-level, much to the disgust of my housemaster at school, who was my teacher. But I'm particularly pleased at the lecture tonight because I've obviously been interested in India and the military connection since my late grandfather's multiple involvements in the country. And I'm aware of some of the difficulties he had as viceroy in separating the two armies. Linda Colley is the perfect choice for this lecture. I always ask for a CV from the lecturers, and she set a new record in that hers was 10 pages long. When I read it, it's 10 pages of serious distinction, and it's far too long for me to do more than encapsulate briefly. For those of you who don't know, she first of all got a first-class degree at Bristol University and then went on to do a PhD at Cambridge and then became a fellow and lecturer at Christ College, Cambridge. From 1982 to 1998, she was at Yale University. From 98 till today, she's here at LSE. She's the Leverhulme Research Professor and School Professor in History. Shortly, she will become the Shelby M. Davis Professor of History at Princeton, and I'm sure that's pretty unique to be both a Yale and Princeton professor. That's something. She has voluminous writings. She's published 4 books and has a 5th in preparation. 9 major essays and 3 further essays in preparation. Also, there have been numerous articles and contributions to books and other writings. And since 1980, she's delivered no fewer than 12 major lectures here in the United Kingdom and in the United States, all around the United States. This is the 13th lecture for her, it appears. And for us, it's rather more than the 13th. I've lost count, so I'm not going to tell you which one it is. But I've been looking forward to this one quite genuinely ever since we conceived it nearly 2 years ago. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to present our lecturer for the evening, Professor Linda Colley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And my subject, for anyone who doesn't know, is the Indian Armed Forces and politics since 1947, putting difference in context. Now, being invited to deliver the Nehru Memorial Lecture must always be an honor. But in my case, it was also something of a surprise. I am primarily a historian of 18th and 19th century Britain and its empire. So the request that I address myself on this occasion to post-independence India and to the question of why its armed forces have remained so conspicuously and remarkably under civilian control, seemed at first perverse and excessively challenging. My doubts, however, were quickly overtaken by curiosity, and for several reasons. I was struck to begin with, as everyone must be, by the magnitude and peculiarity of this particular Indian achievement, both in global and in regional terms. Since the Second World War, it is estimated that more than two-thirds of all countries in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East have experienced some degree of military intervention in and disruption of their political processes, as have some European states such as Greece. India, though, for all its size, internal divisions, and sporadic violence, has managed to avoid this fate. By contrast, India's immediate neighbors, Pakistan and Bangladesh, which shared the same experience of British imperial rule, have succumbed to periods of military rule and martial law. I was struck, too, by the fact that while India's exceptionality in this regard is very well known, it tends to be assumed and applauded rather than analyzed in a comparative and historical perspective. Sunil Kilnani's splendid, highly sophisticated work, The Idea of India, illustrates this point neatly enough. Look up the entry for military in its index, and you find that it's followed immediately by the bold statement, subordinated to civilian control. Although some historians and rather more political scientists have tried to account for this subordination, Kilnani's remark in this same book remains valid. There is little worthwhile on the relationship between the Indian military and politics. One cause of this has been excessive official secrecy. As the historian Ayesha Jalal has complained, in India, as in Pakistan, as in Bangladesh, it remains extraordinarily difficult to gain access to any post-1947 government papers. And this is true in spades of papers relating to the military. In some cases, the relevant documents have been destroyed, as seems to have occurred with many papers to do with India's disastrous 1962 war with China. Many other documents relating to the civil-military interface, though, remain under wraps far longer than is warranted by considerations of national security. Thus, the catalogue of the Nehru Memorial Library in New Delhi reveals that it holds various sets of correspondence dating from the 1940s about the creation of an independent Indian army. 60 years on, these papers are still closed to readers. Yet it is varieties of complacency rather than archival constraints that most inhibit analysis of Indian civil-military relations. One aspect of this is the understandably high level of patriotic pride among Indians about the professionalism of their armed forces, which in practice can work to discourage critical thought and deter inquiry. I was made vividly aware of this when I visited Delhi recently to research this lecture. On one occasion, a senior Indian Army officer to whom I was explaining my project inquired angrily why I was investigating the health of a patient, by which he meant India's armed forces, who was emphatically not sick. While two Congress politicians whom I interviewed, one elderly, the other very young, told me bemusedly that the apolitical nature or otherwise of India's military was something they had simply never thought about. Although far too polite to say so, they clearly saw no reason why I was troubling myself about the issue either. Such reactions, which I encountered several times, were not, I think, prompted merely by the fact that I was an unknown civilian female foreigner asking awkward questions. I have seen this kind of steadfast incuriosity about the relationship between the military and politics before. Indeed, I have seen it here in Britain. In this country too, as Hugh Strawn has written, parliamentary sovereignty over the army is assumed to be the norm, so much so that few people, whether in or outside the academy, bother to inquire how this came to be the case or how far it really always has been the case. In Britain, as in India, the relationship between civilian society and politics on the one hand and the military on the other is usually treated as a benevolent given, not as an important, dynamic, and perplexing issue that requires serious and persistent monitoring and thought. My concern in this lecture will therefore be twofold. I want first to identify and probe those three key factors that have contributed to modern India's success in keeping its military within bounds: the British imperial heritage, the nature of post-1947 Indian politics and society, and the behavior of the Indian armed forces themselves. I want then to return to this issue of excessive complacency and touch on some of the dangers and obfuscations that can result from this, both in India and for the rest of us. But let us begin with what is known and relatively uncontroversial: the factors that have enabled post-1947 India to regulate the ambitions and power of its armed forces. It has become almost a cliche that one of the more benevolent legacies of the Raj was that India was exposed to the British tradition of an apolitical military. When I asked the current Indian Defence Minister, George Fernandez, to account for his country's success in avoiding Praetorian politics, this was the factor he mentioned first. There are some sound reasons for this, for their own purposes of imperial rule, and especially after the rebellion of 1857. The British sought at once to demilitarize Indian society in general and to quarantine their Indian forces in particular away from civilian contacts and their discontents. In the main, they succeeded, with obvious and belated exceptions like the emergence of the INA, the Indian National Army, during the Second World War, and the mutinies in the Royal Indian Navy in 1946, Indian troops in the service of the British Empire after 1857 remained, as has been said, reliable, efficient, and relatively immune to external disturbances, a society within a society. And for all their natural disapproval of this, nationalist politicians were careful after 1947 to preserve and perpetuate many of the devices deployed by the British to keep the Indian soldiery within proper bounds. Thus, India has retained the cantonment system, that is, the 175 or so self-contained military townships, usually placed on the outskirts of cities, which the Raj created so as to insulate its Indian troops from what was styled the contamination of large native centres of population. Since 1947, this system of spatial organisation, so as to quarantine the armed forces, has actually been extended. Modern Indian Air Force and naval bases tend to be located well away from centres of population, and even more than is conventionally the case with cantonments, are out of bounds to civilians. There are other continuities with former imperial military organisation. During the Raj, the British favoured regional army commands, in part as an obstacle to their Indian forces acquiring a collective political voice or momentum. Modern India follows the same policy. Before 1947, the British preferred to recruit Indian troops from rural rather than urban areas, and at the level of the ranks, favoured the very young and uneducated who were believed to be more tractable and impressionable. Modern India still tends to do much the same. India has also, far more than Pakistan, preserved the British regimental system. Unlike non-aligned India, Pakistan in the 1950s joined the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization and the Central Treaty Organization, and was consequently exposed in the decades after independence to extensive American military influence. This, together with growing Islamization since the 1970s, has led to a weakening of traditional regimental ties and practices. In India, however, the regimental system, with its culture, emblems and rituals, its pictures, mascots and silverware, and its officers' mess, is passionately adhered to, and this has undoubtedly assisted an apolitical ethos. The whole point of the regimental system, whether in India or Britain, is that the loyalty of officers and men is directed towards the lesser institution, namely the regiment, not the greater, the army as a whole. Among other things, this serves in both countries as an obstacle to the military acquiring a collective and potentially disruptive political identity. It needs recognizing, however, that the military legacies of the Raj were sometimes ambivalent. It is likely, for instance, that when so-called Indianization of the imperial forces began after 1918, and a limited number of Indians were admitted for the first time to commissioned rank, these men learned to be apolitical, not simply by being exposed to British example, but also by running the gauntlet of a measure of British racism. As Field Marshal Auchinleck, then Commander-in-Chief in India, admitted in 1946, prejudice and lack of manners by some, by no means all, British officers and their wives, all went to produce a very deep and bitter feeling of racial discrimination in the minds of the most intelligent and progressive of the Indian officers. And one can find ample corroboration of this in biographies and autobiographies of those Indian officers who earned their commissions in the 1920s and 30s. Yet however aggrieved they were by the attitudes of some Britons, and however anxious some were to see the British leave, the vast majority of this first generation or so of Indian officers remained staunchly and conventionally loyal. They continued up to 1947 to obey their oath to the Crown and do their job. This was not a bad training, when you think about it, in unremitting professionalism. And the new Indian nation which inherited these officers may well have benefited from these men's earlier internalization of the need to put personal and political discontents firmly to one side and always to serve and obey the authorities of the day. There's another caveat that needs making, I think, about the traditional, sometimes over-roseate, interpretation of Britain's military legacy in India. Post-1947 India undeniably drew on officers and men trained by the Raj, and it still draws on some of its military practices. But independent India has also departed from British military conventions in some significant respects. So-called British martial race policy, which had led since the 1870s to recruiting being concentrated in mainly northerly regions of India, was, for instance, substantially, though not entirely, abandoned. Some groupings much favoured by the Raj, such as Sikhs, are still disproportionately represented in India's armed forces. But in general, recruits now come from a much broader geographical, cultural, social, and ethnic range, as well as was always the case, from a variety of religions. This aids the military's utility in India as a national emblem and cement. More diverse recruitment arguably also ensures against the Indian armed forces developing a uniform identity and agenda distinct from service to the state. The obvious contrast here would be with Pakistan, where the army is both overwhelmingly Muslim and about 70% Punjabi. In other ways too, keeping its armed forces in line may have been assisted by what India discarded from the Raj, and not just by what it retained. In India, as in other parts of the empire, as at home, the British preached the virtues of an apolitical military, but they did not always practice them. The British takeover of India in the second half of the 18th and early 19th centuries was, after all, itself a military coup of sorts, staged by private armies of the East India Company. Right up to the Second World War, when the number of Indian troops totaled some 2.5 million, the military remained indispensable to British imperial control and absorbed a disproportionate amount of the imperial budget. And throughout the imperial era, there was a succession of British males on horseback who combined major military roles in the subcontinent with significant political activity there, and very often political roles in Britain as well. In early 19th century India, for instance, there was Arthur Wellesley, a ruthlessly effective general whose equally ambitious brother was Governor General and who himself went on to become a British Prime Minister. And in the early 20th century, there was General Lord Kitchener, Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army, who, amongst other things, used his influence in Calcutta and Whitehall to unseat the civilian viceroy, Lord Curzon. In India then, though not just in India, the British military possessed a schizoid quality, avowedly apolitical, at times and in practice, elements within it acted as anything but. So it was scarcely surprising, and I move on now to my second main factor, that the civilian nationalists who took charge of India in 1947 wanted to pare down the military and keep it firmly in line. Many of the Congress Party's leading figures at this time, as is well known, had spent part of their youth in Oxbridge or the Inns of Court or both. They were therefore familiar with English constitutional and legal theories about the necessary subordination of the military to the civil power. But they were also familiar with the more praetorian aspects of that British Raj against which they had struggled for so long, and intent on constructing a very different kind of India. Nehru in particular, though careful to establish links before independence with various sympathetic Indian officers, was always, I think, intellectually ambivalent about the military. Not simply because he associated it with the departing British and their empire, but also because of his socialism, his commitment to Gandhian ideals, and his belief in internationalism and non-alignment. After 1947, Nehru strove for a ceiling on the Indian army of 175,000 men. Until the last few years of his life, the defense budget was often kept very tight as resources were shifted to industrial development. And various constitutional and symbolic devices were adopted to underline military subordination to the civil power. Thus, Nehru pointedly selected as his prime ministerial residence in New Delhi, Teenmurti House, which before 1947 had been the mansion of the military commander-in-chief in India. This particular military office was abolished, and instead each of the three services was given its own chief of staff, thereby, of course, carefully encouraging inter-service rivalry. These service chiefs and other senior Indian officers were expected to communicate with the politicians only through the Defence Ministry, which was headed by a civilian and staffed solely by civil servants. There were also changes in the warrants of presidents in 1951 and 1963, and again after Nehru's death in 1971, so that even the most senior army, navy, and air force officers in India found themselves ranking below civilian grandees from the Supreme Court, the Cabinet Secretariat, and the various state bureaucracies. Now, this distancing from and diminution of things military by Nehru and his cohorts had its downside. Nehru's choice of civilian defense ministers was repeatedly unwise, and his instinctive suspicion of those wearing uniform sometimes compromised Indian foreign policy. When in 1951, the chief of the army staff, General Kariappa, delivered a lengthy warning to Nehru about Chinese military pretensions, he was bluntly told it was not his job to tell the prime minister who is going to attack us where. And until the crisis of 1962, the armed forces were often underfunded. Indian troops dispatched to fight the Chinese that year had no emergency rations. Some even didn't have boots. Nonetheless, any assessment of why civilian rule and democratic elections were able to take tenacious root in India has to make ample room for Nehru. His intellectual stature, prestige, political commitment, and even his patrician aura and confidence proved invaluable. So emphatically did his longevity. It is sometimes forgotten that Jinnah was just as ambivalent about the military as Nehru, and just as determined in Pakistan to keep it in line. You do not make national policy, he told his soldiers. It is we, the civilians, who decide these issues. But Jinnah died in 1948. Nehru survived until 1964. Functioning as a fellow Congress politician famously remarked, as the banyan tree under whose shade millions could take shelter. There were other respects too, in which India, in the wake of partition, found itself far more advantageously positioned than Pakistan. And this helps to account for, though it did not determine, the two nations' differing military experiences. In 1947, India inherited Delhi and its bureaucracy, the core of the old colonial state. But no such continuity of centralized political infrastructure was made available to Pakistan. In Indavar Kamtekar's words, it is an oversimplification with some truth to say that while in India independence involved restructuring a state, in Pakistan it involved building a state. Delhi existed, Islamabad had to be built. Right from the start then, civilian administration in Pakistan faced greater pressures and was at greater risk. There were also from the outset important socio-economic differences between the two countries. Pakistan had and still has a powerful, fairly exclusive landed class intimately linked to the upper echelons of its military and bureaucracy. India, though, while struggling like Pakistan with extreme poverty and inequality, possessed even in 1947 a more developed industrial sector and a bigger commercial population. Together with subsequent measures of land reform, this has almost certainly assisted its comparative political stability. As Amos Perlmutter has observed, the middle classes in most praetorian states are small, weak, and ineffective. By contrast, states which are more diverse in their social structure and economy are generally less likely to succumb to military takeover because their ambitious, upwardly mobile elements have access to a wider spectrum of careers and pathways to influence. One of the most vivid demonstrations, both of India's occupational diversity and of the limits of its military, are perhaps the advertisements for marriage partners that are published in its newspaper press every week. As these reveal, a minority of Indian parents are still anxious for their daughters to marry Army, Navy, and Air Force officers. But many more Indian families now seek alliances with computer scientists, doctors, civil servants, industrial executives, etc. Hardly ever with academics. I wonder why. Here is richly human proof that wearing uniform is not the main or even a major pathway to status, influence, and power in India. There is also the matter of geography, which is so obvious and consequently so easy to ignore. One reason why Great Britain has been able, for most of its history, to have a smaller army than other comparably aggressive European powers is that it is surrounded by the sea. Greater immunity from foreign invasion has assisted regulation of the size and political intrusiveness of the military at home. By the same token, while India is obviously not an island, it is a huge triangular peninsula. It is defended on two of its three sides by the sea. To be sure, its existence as an independent nation has been punctuated by wars and bitter border disputes. Nonetheless, in terms of frontiers, India possesses a considerable inbuilt advantage over Pakistan, which is landlocked on three sides and almost circled by much larger and more powerful states. Russia looming down on Afghanistan to its north, China to its east, India to its south. Pakistan's frontier geography makes it liable to perpetual insecurity, not to say paranoia. And this was always likely to have military repercussions. So let me summarize the argument thus far. I have been outlining, while also problematizing, some of the main factors behind India's relative success in keeping its military within bounds. I have stressed the considerable degree to which the Raj's military organization, discipline, and ethos proved valuable in this respect and was retained after 1947. I also stressed, however, the more praetorian aspects of British imperium in India and the extent to which nationalists after 1947 reacted against this. I have underlined the role of modern India's founding fathers and crucially Nehru in implanting civilian rule and democracy, while drawing attention as well to more impersonal and fortuitous influences. To establish how it came about that, I quote, a common British colonial legacy led to apparently contrasting patterns of political development, democracy in India, and military authoritarianism in Pakistan. It is not enough to resort to the great man theory of history. Still less is it appropriate to resort to explanations couched in terms of religion. We have to look, among other things, at how the spoils were divided at partition, at social and economic conditions in these two countries, and at their differing geographies and frontier systems. But what of the contribution of the Indian military itself? The scale of its success and reinvention since 1947 has been remarkable. With the exception of those who defected to the INA, the Indian military did not fight for national independence. In contrast with parts of the Americas, Africa, and the Middle East, there was no armed struggle here, in which very large numbers of local troops turned against their colonial rulers. This is arguably one more reason, indeed, why India's armed forces have remained within bounds, while those of other post-colonial nations have not. In India, there could be no convincing large-scale mystification of the man in uniform as preeminent freedom fighter. On the contrary, the fact that the vast majority of India's military had fought with the British, not against them, meant that at independence, the former were initially on the defensive. Up till now, wrote Gandhi famously, the armed forces had only been employed in indiscriminate firing on us. Today they must plough the land, dig wells, clean latrines, and do every constructive work that they can, and thus turn the people's hatred of them into love. Yet within a short space of time, India's military was able to shift from being to some degree suspect, imperial lackeys in the eyes of their critics, to being a prime focus of national pride. How was this Voltfast engineered, and how was it controlled? One of the crucial figures involved was K.M. Kariappa, commonly known as the father of the modern Indian army. Talking to India officers now, it's clear that opinions differ about Kariappa's abilities as a military commander, but there can be little dispute about his importance, instincts, and adroitness in the wake of independence, having forged links with nationalist politicians only very belatedly. Kariappa rapidly adjusted to the new order. He recognized that India's military needed to reassure Congress by being at once dazzlingly professional and sturdily apolitical. He understood, too, that the Indian armed forces needed, after a fashion, to reinvent themselves. So at one level, he persuaded Nehru not to readmit to the armed services, all the officers and men who had defected to the INA, which was what some nationalists wanted. Politics, even nationalist politics, must not be allowed to compromise military discipline. As army chief, Kariappa also regularly addressed and circularized the army on the paramount importance of remaining aloof from any kind of partisanship. Understand politics, but do not get involved in its processes, he told his officers in 1949. I want to make it clear, he informed the ranks, that you are not politicians. You are Indians first and Indians last. At another level, and as is suggested by this latter speech, Kariappa and his circle worked at Indianizing the army in fact and in the politicians' and public's estimation. Whereas high-ranking British officers remained in important positions in Pakistan's army way into the 1950s, the majority of Britons seeking to hang on in the Indian army were shunted out within a year or two of independence. The Indian army in independent India, Kariappa declared in his first speech to the press as army chief in 1949, was a people's army, and the gulf that previously existed between the army and the people was now a thing of the past. Since in reality, as we have seen, the Indian armed forces retained many aspects of former British military organization, one might have expected that this would have obstructed their acceptance as a national people's army. Yet over time, this proved not to be the case. As represented and reimagined by Kariappa and his kind, the Raj became merely a minor interlude in an ages-old story of Indian armed valor that had now re-emerged from the shadow of empire to take its proper place in the light. One can see this adroit process of reinvention at work even before independence in the proceedings of the Armed Forces Nationalization Committee, set up by Congress late in 1946, and in which Kariappa played a leading part. The Indian Army is not a new force, declared the committee's chairman in February 1947. It has a history and high traditions. While the committee's draft report began by stating that the history of India is rich in martial tradition, the military achievements of her armies from the earlier times up to the present day are second to none in the world. It is in the light of this skillful work of nationalist reimagining, which Kariappa and his kind championed and fostered, that one should understand some aspects of Indian military visual culture even now. Enter the officers' mess of one of the more traditional Indian regiments, and you will still see displayed on the walls paintings by British military artists of Indian troops fighting for Queen Victoria's empire. Visit a prime New Delhi hotel, and you will probably be struck by the number of antique prints on show of fearsome Indian soldiers in the uniforms of the Raj. These displays should not be understood as connoting Anglophilia or imperial nostalgia. To an extraordinary degree, these one-time imperial images have been reclaimed and nationalized, converted into wholesome, cheering representations of an eternal, distinctively Indian valor. As we have seen, there are all kinds of reasons why the Indian military's success in reinventing and nationalizing itself in the wake of independence has not been accompanied by its evolving as well an intrusive political role. But there's one more factor in this regard that I want to mention before moving on to the last part of my lecture. Virtually all nations define themselves by reference to a real or imagined other. While the roots of its nationalism are many, India is no exception in this respect. Its most prominent other since 1947, the polity against which it has chosen most to define itself, has, of course, been Pakistan. And this has surely had some impact on the self-image of India's warriors. The fact that Pakistan's armed forces have both intervened in politics and been defeated in successive wars with India's armed forces has, I suspect, only confirmed the latter in the view that an apolitical military is also the best military. For India's armed forces, proclaiming their apolitical nature, functions, among many other things, as a way of proclaiming difference from Pakistan. It also functions as a way of proclaiming superiority. We come back then to issues of complacency. I hope I've been able to convey this evening how remarkable is India's relationship with its armed forces, as well as why this has happened in the way that it has. But celebration of what has been achieved in this regard, while legitimate, is insufficient. The armed forces of India have done the nation proud, declared a leading Indian military publication in 2000. One need not look far to appreciate what a priceless asset they are, admired the world over for their commitment to professional values and to the constitution of India. Well, yes, but India's military, like the military in every other state, needs thinking about more searchingly and more broadly than this. So let me end by touching on some of the reasons why we need to think about these relations, these civil-military relations in India and elsewhere more. And let me look at four constituencies in this regard. Scholars, India's politicians, the Indian public, and the rest of us. As far as scholarly analysis is concerned, it is vital, I think, to get away from the notion that because military coups have not occurred in India since 1947 and seem unlikely in the future, therefore its armed forces are simply to be viewed as apolitical. This kind of bogus dichotomy, military takeovers on the one hand, thoroughly apolitical armed forces on the other, has hobbled several otherwise excellent studies of civil-military relations in India. What is needed is a more nuanced, and if it ever becomes possible, archivally based analysis of the relations and tensions over time between modern Indian governments and the military. Because such sources are available make clear that there have been several periods since 1947 of extreme tension and anxiety. Let me just mention two. When Nehru died in 1964 and General Chowdhury moved troops into Delhi in case there was unrest, Chowdhury subsequently revealed that during this time his phone was tapped. Clearly, there were some in the government establishment who feared that this might be a prelude to a coup. Then again, there is Field Marshal Sam Manekshaw's anecdote of Indira Gandhi asking him point blank during the declaration of emergency in the mid-1970s whether he intended a military coup. Several historians and political scientists have poured scorn on this anecdote, but when I was in India, a former high-level minister confirmed to me that such an exchange had taken place. Manekshaw is supposed to have said to her, "You are far too pretty to coo against." As far as scholars are concerned, it would be nice, to put it mildly, if we could progress beyond anecdotes such as these to a more informed understanding of the changing tenor of civil-military relations during India's first half century as a nation. This really needs studying. But India's rulers have far more practical and far more pressing reasons to think more closely and more creatively about its armed forces. In all nations, including this one, politicians easily succumb to two very different mistakes about the military. They can become overdazzled and obsessed by the military's glamour, power, and apparently simple virtues. One thinks of Margaret Thatcher posing in the tank. Conversely, politicians can also fail to be sufficiently interested in learning about and understanding both the potential and the limitations of their armed forces. Since 1947, Indian politicians have sometimes succumbed to the second of these profound mistakes. And perhaps a conspicuous example would be Operation Golden Star in 1984, where clearly the civilian authorities get it wrong several times. They fail to appreciate the significance that the dissidents are led by a former major general, and what discipline this is likely to confer on them, which is why when the temple is invaded, there are so many casualties. The government also failed, or so it would seem, sufficiently to consider that all Indian troops take both a political oath and an oath according to their particular religion, and that therefore Sikh troops, so disproportionately represented in the armed forces in India, would be put under enormous strain by what was happening. For failing to take sufficient cognizance of this, Mrs. Gandhi arguably paid with her life. More generally, some Indian officers feel very strongly that the bureaucratic distance between the military and the politicians that was established after 1947, in order to keep the former in its place, obstructs and blunts proper and effective communication and planning in defense matters. It will be interesting to see what changes are implemented in this connection in the wake of the Kargil affair. And what of the Indian people at large? As an Indian general wrote in 1998, despite 50 years of our independence, most educated people in India know little about the complexities of defense and national security, and most uneducated people in India know even less. Yet surely, anyone interested in the preservation of India's democracy must be vitally concerned about the military. This does not mean speculating in an alarmist fashion about a possible coup, but rather recognizing real causes of concern and thinking about them more. For example, in recent years, there have been growing attempts by some Hindu fundamentalists to infiltrate and propagandize among the armed forces. As one minister said to me, this is a disruptive trend which one will have to monitor indeed. Then again, surely anyone interested in the preservation of India's democracy must be concerned about the excessive use of the armed forces to suppress internal and communal violence. The army is now being used to monitor internal disruption in India far more than it was used in the Raj. And this can have damaging consequences in all sorts of ways. But perhaps the greatest threat, and this is not an original point, is that growing corruption and division among sections of India's civilian political class and bureaucracy could conceivably have military consequences. The undeniable professionalism of India's armed forces is no necessary defense against their at some future point interfering in politics out of a sense of exasperation with the civil order. As General S.L. Menzies has written in his excellent history of the Indian Army, the greatest threat Indian democracy can face today is the politicization of the armed forces. And what, finally, about the rest of us? Well, we need to think more about civil-military relations too. All militaries, however they behave and whatever they profess, are quintessentially political institutions in that they embody their respective states' determination to monopolize violence. Yet in democracies, civilians generally devote very little critical thought and inquiry to the armed forces in their midst. This, I would argue, is short-sighted and unwise. Armed forces which are no longer recruited by conscription can become unduly separated from the mainstream of society. And as recent events have demonstrated, what modern armed forces can now do against even sizable and fairly sophisticated societies can be rapid and terrifying indeed. Acknowledging this is not in any way an invitation to fantasizing about coups, but it is a plea for wider, more informed discussion and awareness of a section and wing of the state that we too often take for granted or ignore. A political scientist has recently observed that, I quote, "The relationship of the soldier to the state in Asia is not a settled issue." I would agree with this remark, but I would also extend it. The relationship of the soldier to the state in every continent is not a settled issue. We all need to think much harder about it than we do. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have time for a few minutes of questions, if I may moderate. We'll start. Gentleman, the check shirt.
It is very nice, Gandhi's final word is Aram Say. So it is very nice to have an English man whose name is also Aram Say to have this Pandit Nehruji's lecture. And Professor Linda, let me begin by appreciating the Victorian family for giving the coolies, I mean the Indian soldiers, even after 47, we were lured to work in your army, I mean the Imperial Army. Okay, fight with us, we will give you early independence. Even now we get type on, pension, so we appreciate you. Still, you treat us as in par with you, equal opportunity to English Army. Thank you. So, we need modernization, as you rightly said, both the Indian Army and the Chinese Army need modernization. Not merely the numbers will not do, because 10 Englishmen is equal to 1,000 Englishmen or Indian man. So, what we need is modernization. Such a modernized army will be a boon for United Nations, because what is happening in your peacekeeping force or your reconstructive Iraq, as much as hatred is for your own army, that much as hatred is for
Iran. Do you have a specific question?
Yes, modernization. See, it is about our army. Let us be patient. Still, we need your modernization. Number two, you people, you still sponges. Oh, we'll trade with us, we'll give you arms, so that you can fight with your own divide and rule policy. Rather than giving us army, why don't you give us know-how technology? Okay? So, we give you workforce. I'm a doctor, I work for you. When you get retired, I'll treat you, even if you are sane or insane. Okay? So, give us know-how. So, here, let me appeal to your Arab leagues that come and join with us. Our president is a DRDO, your president is a scientist. So, let us have our own weapons, rather than Western weapons, so that we will have our own self-sufficiency, so the United Nations will be a wonderful institution, not you people, okay? Number three is employment. Indian Army is still a buffer for us, okay? So let us focus on our economically vulnerable Muslims, our scheduled caste, or in the Northeast, we still have insurgency, thanks to your CIA or whatever, you still drop us arms so that we can fight. Number four is human rights, okay? Number four is, okay.
How long is your list?
I don't know. How long? When it was centuries that we had you.
We'll have number four.
Okay,
hang on. What's
so your human rights.
Four?
That is what we need from Europeans. Our army needs human rights. Okay? This is because what happens in Punjab, nobody is persecuted. And finally, pact, like your NATO. I may not have a pact with China or Pakistan, but what we need is that if you could help us to solve the problem which you created, Kashmir or Taiwan, we can, our Indian army, as Gandhi said, can provide sanitation to our own people, and so that one day we will have our own precious India, the jewel of your crown. Wonderful. Thanks that you still remember us, and we remember you forever.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did touch upon the infiltration, or rather the attempted infiltration of the Hindu right wing in the army. That does not concern me as much as another thing, because you did mention that the traditional recruiting ground for the army is in the rural backwaters, and that is where the RSS is most active in recent times. So what I'm thinking of is, in subsequent generations of soldiers, they will already come to the army with some political baggage, because they are being recruited since a very early age as puritanical vigilantes, and they have these militant religious nationalism with them. So do you think that in the forthcoming, in the future generations of the Indian Army, the depoliticization of the Indian Army, which is its merit, will weaken?
I think that there, you cannot look at armed forces detached from the society generally, and that's true in all contexts. And it is bogus to assume that the armed forces in India can be insulated from wider movements. And this is partly why I was arguing that complacency can be a problem. I mean, when these Congress politicians, and they may have been disingenuous, told me, well, this is something we don't think about, my feeling is, well, you damn well should think about it. And as you're suggesting, that there has tended to be, which is a sort of carrying over from the Raj, a preference for recruiting in rural areas. Of course, that sort of originated in the notion that the rural areas were much less politicized. But as you're suggesting, that isn't necessarily the case. And I think that will have to be monitored. Another thing that will have to be monitored is, and I was told this by a young Indian officer, one of the few I was able to speak to, and he said there's been an increasing tendency, partly because the salary structure is poor, of army officers leaving the career early to go, in some cases, into politics. And I think that touches on a much wider issue, which all societies are experiencing in one way or the other. How do you get and keep high-caliber people in your public services, including the armed forces, when the salary structure is lagging so conspicuously behind the private sector? And I do think that the problem of recruiting high caliber committed people, both at the ranks and at officer level, is something that, you know, is going to have to be monitored and thought about.
There's Mike.
Good evening, everybody. Now, just now you referred about the salary structure, you see. Let me take on that first one. Now, salary structure, not only army forces, but it's right the way throughout the industry and everywhere. Recently, 20 applications, 20 jobs, there were 20 vacancies, but in technical field, and the applications were £9,000. 9,000 applicants, you see.
Please, could you actually, what I'm saying
that it's not salary structure in army forces, but it's right throughout the industry there's a salary structure problem, you see. So you cannot differentiate army from the rest of the society. So this will continue to have it till the country comes bit up, you see. Now let me talk about the, you said about the army is being used, you see, in very frequently. Now, if the army is not used, what the journalists will write, that they were Hindus and Muslim riots, and the Muslims have been murdered by the Hindu National Party. So the government has got a problem, because there are more Muslims in India than Muslims in Pakistan. So in order to keep the balance, you see, between Hindus and Muslims, so that they, it doesn't spread anywhere, they have to use the army for that purpose, you see. Because sometimes the police is accused.
I'm sorry, this is really meant to be a question, not a statement.
Can I?
Because there are a lot of other things which I can challenge on these things, you see.
Can I? I mean, I'm sure, obviously, we want to get as, you know, give as many people a chance with questions as possible. But, you know, let me. I quite understand the dilemma. But, of course, initially, there has been an enormous expansion of paramilitary forces in India. And it was hoped that those would be the groups to monitor civil disturbance. All I was doing was really making the point, which I think all societies have to be aware of, that if you use the military too much to maintain civil order, you blunt its influence over time. And also, of course, you run the danger that the military will be politicized by what it has to do.
And can I have one point about democracy?
We're moving on.
You see?
Yes, hi.
Okay.
A
question, please.
Yes, it will be. Appreciate your lecture. One thing that I wanted to, that I was just wondering about. I know you. I know that, you know, within a scope of a study, I'm a student myself. So even though I might not know it as well as you, but I know that you can only study a certain time frame. But you did talk about the reinvention, or sort of like the reinventing Indian nationalism within the Indian Army after 1947, if you will. What I was wondering about was that, since if you predate the British Raj in India, and I don't mean to sort of reinvent a circle, I think, but I had a genuine question, and my question is that if you do that, you go back to military traditions of people like Guru Gobind Singh or Shivaji, who were both military leaders and political heads of their state. Now, how would that play into a modern Indian military, which does look up to these traditions even today? I mean, do you see, or you know, that the effect of, let's say, that system, if you will, a system that predates the British Raj on Indian civil military relations today?
That is a huge question, obviously, and I think it impinges on the mythology of the military, which again is an area which, you know, needs a lot of work. I suppose what, and of course you're quite right, there is a very long military tradition. There's all sorts of military traditions in the subcontinent. I'm not remotely denying that. What I was interested in was how very quickly and very adeptly men like Kariapa sort of have to cope with this fact that the military has been so crucial in propping up the Raj. And how do you do this when you adjust to the new regime of independence? And as I say, you can see this in this very fascinating 1946-47 committee, the papers of which are available in the National Army Museum here. I'm sure they're in India too, but you probably can't get them there, but you can consult them in the National Army Museum. And the sort of mythological spinnings and jumps there to say, well, okay, we admit the Raj, but, you know, it's just an interlude. It's a much longer story than this, which we're now taking up again and we're taking into the modern regime. And that's very sophisticated. It's common enough when you look at post-colonial regimes to see them being iconoclastic about relics of the former colonial power. But what is really happening here is that relics are being reimagined and nationalized. And that's much rarer. But I think your wider point about military mythologies is very important and needs working on.
Gentleman at the back.
Thank you very much. This is going back to exceptionalism in the case of the Indian Army. You did mention a variety of factors, and I do sympathize with them. But there's one factor which I think you have not mentioned. That is, though India and Pakistan came to birth at the same time, it was not the same movement that gave birth to Pakistan and to India. India came to independent stature propelled by a national movement, a colonial national movement. Pakistan came into being because it was anti-Congress and anti-India. The national movement in India had a very wide range of programs, including Zamindari abolition and so on and so forth, which gave it a kind of stature and sustenance. Pakistan was really, from its very beginning, very security conscious. It was afraid of India, and that is probably why the military got such a high profile in Pakistan in contrast to India. I think the fact that India and Pakistan the nativity of these two countries was almost identical. At the same time, it's true that these two countries came into being because of different factors, not the same national movement that gave birth to India and to Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a huge topic, and, you know, I had 55 minutes. I mean, I think that the genesis of partition and the different factors leading into it, I mean, it is important to recognize the differences. It is also important not to overstate them. But you're quite right in the sense that, you know, this could have been talked about much longer. But I don't think you would have wanted to sit down necessarily for longer than an hour.
I'm going to allow two more questions. I've already chosen them. Gentlemen up there.
On the discussion that you had about the military political relationship, how much we listen to the belt tightening, that is curtailing the defense expenditures, and how much did you recall discussions from the politicians or the army officers about the guns versus butter argument? That whether there is a genuine need felt and echoed and voiced, that whether to contain the military budget, there is a discussion going on?
Well, you know, that's a huge issue. What I have to make clear is that, I'm a visiting Brit, barging in on important, busy people and asking impertinent questions. What I was able to ask and what I was able to get in return was limited. But, you know, by seeing enough people and by piecing enough together, I think I got something. And given that the archives are closed, it was a lot better than nothing. But I agree that the budgetary factor is crucial. And of course, one thing I have not talked about, because it's simply too huge, is India becoming a nuclear power and what the implications of that are for budgetary issues, for social issues, and for the political status of the armed forces and their relationship with the civilian authorities, because all this, you know, is, I think, a huge area.
Final question.
Yes, Dr. Connolly, I have a question about the British Army. I think most people would go along with your thesis, the connection and the relationship between the British Army and the Indian Army. I have a question about the operation of the British Army in Iraq. Again, most fair-minded people would go along with the operation of the British Army in Basra, where they seem to have developed a better relationship with the local population than the American Army in Baghdad. Why do you think the British Army, in its dealing with ordinary people, seems to be better than the Americans?
Having spent 16 years of my life in the United States and being about to go back there this fall, I'm not quite sure how I answer that.
Linda?
It's intriguing, isn't it? I mean, I suppose I would want to know if this is really factually so, because obviously we read British newspapers here, which are likely to give a certain spin. But I do think the regimental organization of the British Army has all sorts of repercussions which needs exploration. It doesn't make the British nicer, gentler people. You don't get the empire the size they had by being sweet. But it may be that, of course, the experience of running empire in the past and the very different organization feeds into how the British have behaved. But as I say, I withhold comments until I have caught up with what US newspapers say, which, for all I know, may be saying how much nicer the American troops are than the British.
Ladies and gentlemen, obviously we could probably go on all night, but sadly time precludes that. I would like to, on behalf of you, the audience, thank Linda Colley for what was clearly an outstandingly interesting lecture. And I would just like to pass a comment on possibly answering the last question, if I may. I think the experience of the units, and that is most of the army, that have served in Northern Ireland over the last 30 to 40 years is very significant in the way they've reacted in Basra. I'm quite convinced of that, together with the fact that the discipline has always been very high in the British Army. Anyway, sorry, that's not really my job, but I couldn't resist it. Anyway, Linda, thank you very much for an outstanding lecture, and thank you to the LSE for hosting it.